Hello and welcome back to Heights Libraries podcast, Unpacking 1619, where you can explore the interviews we've collected with scholars from around the country, in which we unpack topics relating to race in America. I'm your host, John Pichet, and I'm thrilled to share these interviews with you here. Our exploration of the intersections of race and education continues this week with my interview with Professor Derek Black. We talked back in May about his new book, Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy.
Hello, I'm Derek Black. I'm a professor of law at the University of South Carolina, where I teach constitutional law, civil rights, and voting. But my real area of focus is in education, law, and policy, where I've written a handful of books and a ton of articles.
Well, thank you for joining us. And we're going to talk today mostly about your book, Schoolhouse Burning, Public Education and the Assault on American Democracy. And I guess if you could just kind of explain to us what the book attempts to do and what the assault on American democracy means in the context of the book.
Yeah, I mean, the book tries to situate the last decade or so of public education into a much larger historical narrative. So, you know, the last decade or so has seen a tremendous amount of privatization, either through vouchers or charters. It's also seen the underfunding of its public schools and a little bit of just sort of hostility towards public schools in general from some circles. And, you know, it's very easy to sort of get caught up in the immediacy of the moment and to start analyzing the data and analyzing the policies. And I've done all that before, but the book says, wait a minute, there's a much larger American phenomenon that has been occurring for at least 200 years here. And we really ought to think about this snapshot in time in relationship to that and really ask ourselves, if we can identify some big trends from that period in history and some goals in that period in history, then maybe instead of asking ourselves, you know, are students scoring better in this charter school, or are they scoring worse in this charter school, or in this, you know, asking those questions, or who is it that, you know, is this creating racial segregation or not? And those are legitimate questions to ask, but instead of getting too hung up in that, to ask a big question and say, are these current policies regarding funding, charters, vouchers, et cetera, are they moving us closer to our original goals in public education or further away? And I think hopefully that brings clarity to all of these, you know, sort of onslaught of bills and funding battles that we're having. So that's my goal. Now, the conclusion that I come to in the book is that what we are seeing, what we're experiencing, ought to be understood as an assault on American democracy, because the larger narrative connects public education to democratic ideas and goals, and then says, look, seeing what's happening in education is not just a threat to education, it's a threat to these larger democratic goals that public education is supposed to serve.
Well, that was interesting too, because you begin the book kind of defining what those goals are and who initially set them out. I was surprised to learn kind of the history of education with the, you know, the people who founded the country, and what was it, Adams and Jefferson. And why do you think, maybe you could speak a little bit about their ideas and why you think they're kind of discredited or ignored today?
Yeah, I mean, I've never used this word before, but you triggered in my mind. I mean, you know, Jefferson and Adams were education wonks, right? You know, not that there were wonks back then, but they really were. They were education wonks. And they were also education idealists, you know. So on the one hand, what is the ideal system? Why do we need it? And then, like, how do we execute it? And John Adams is probably the biggest on the idea end of things. You know, he was writing before the Revolutionary War about the role of education and democracy, and and how important it was to sort of bringing disparate economic classes and castes, I guess we might call them, together in society, about finding the common good, right? I mean, they're imagining a democratic project that they don't really have any rules for other than, Greeks and Romans, which is a much different form than what they were instituting. And so Adam's really enamored by this idea that if we're handing over the vote to average folks, they need to be educated. They need to be able to find the common good. And so he puts that in the Massachusetts Constitution of 1785, which predates, the United States Constitution. And as folks point out, there's a lot of things that a lot of major things that the U.S. Constitution takes from the Massachusetts Constitution: separation of powers, certain liberties, structure of government. Like, all that's a copy off of Adams' original Constitution. But what Adams also puts in there is the world's first, at least the United States' first education clause that constitutionally mandates Massachusetts to provide this education, right? Because it is a centerpiece of democracy. Now, Jefferson has many of those same ideas. He talks a little bit more about it in terms of liberty. I think I'm actually being clearer about this distinction than I ever had before, because you asked about both of them. But, Jefferson is a little bit different, I think, though, in that he is really thinking about the individual's ability to guard their own liberty. And he says, in the absence of of education or level of knowledge, you won't fully be able to understand your place in society. You won't fully be able to understand your interests, and you won't be able to defend them against the other folks who do have education. So he thinks of it more as individual liberty, and the state needs to provide it. Otherwise, individuals are weak. And I think Adams is a little bit more, sort of socialist about it, to use that term. But then Jefferson goes one step further. Right? They're both committed to this education project. Jefferson begins to sort of outline specifically by policy how Virginia could make sure everyone in the state had access to it, a bill for the general diffusion of knowledge. Now, that bill doesn't become law in Virginia. For one reason, they're in the middle of war, and Virginia held a tremendous amount of the war debt. So they just didn't feel they were in position to make that major contribution. But his policy, his wonkish policy, does make its way into the Northwest Ordinances of 1787, which then do set the rules for Ohio in particular. It's sort of the first state in the Northwest territories as to what society is going to look like, and putting education at the center of it. And again, the Northwest Ordinance is a foundational document that the Constitution builds upon, because the Northwest Ordinance actually precedes the United States Constitution.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing I learned from your book about that one. So maybe you could speak a little bit more about that. And then I kind of want to get into the slavery aspect of it in post-Civil War.
Yeah, well, folks in Ohio are always not the butt of my joke, but at least because it's not a joke, but it is a sort of I think something I try to make crystal clear to folks who aren't from Ohio. And I always say, any of you ever driven, from Kentucky into Ohio, have any of you ever driven from Pennsylvania over into Ohio? If you have, and back in the old days when we used to carry maps, physical maps around, you would have noticed something incredibly strange, which is there's all these straight lines, dividing the counties in Ohio. But in Pennsylvania, they're as jagged as the Appalachian Trail, and the same thing in Kentucky. So why is it that everything is so square in Ohio? And so anything but square everywhere else. And we could say that same thing about all the states to the west of Ohio. And the answer to that, as probably they teach hopefully they teach in public schools there in Ohio well, is that, you know, Ohio is part of the Northwest Ordinance. And the Northwest Ordinance, again, sort of coming from Jefferson's idea, cuts up every square inch in the remaining territory of the United States and says, here's what it's going to take to become a state. You know, here's the rules and regulations. It lays out basically what we would call a Bill of Rights. In that Bill of Rights, right, it says that that these territories shall provide education. But more importantly, and here's the wonkish part of it, it carves up every square inch of land, and it covers up all, cuts up that land into towns, and each town has 32 lots, exactly 32 lots, which makes you sort of a perfect square of lots. And there are four center lots, if you've got a box with 32, and one of those four center lots is the 16th lot. And the Northwest Ordinance says that the 16th lot in every town in the rest of America will be reserved for the building of a school. And that, I think, a ninth, although it doesn't indicate exactly which lots, but a ninth of the outlying lots shall be reserved to generate resources to fund those schools. So we've literally had this sort of structural blueprint that puts schools at the center of it and obligates those towns to fund those schools through resources. And so it becomes a foundational pillar of how the nation will grow. And it wasn't just those in the Northwest Ordinance. Basically, all of the states except for the original colonies and the ones that sort of came before Ohio, everyone else, some 30 some odd states, all of the rest of them are structured and enter into the union based upon that the rules that it originally found in the Northwest Ordinance. So that's important. I guess I'll make one other point, which is to link a lot of people. There's like, why do you keep talking about the Northwest Ordinance? It's whatever. You know, in the book, I say it is the land deal that makes the United States Constitution possible. So if we rewind to that moment in time, we've got a couple of problems if you're trying to form a new constitution. Number one is, well, how are we going to have new states? Like, you know, what's a new state going to look like? What's the rules for it? Well, Northwest Ordinance specifies those things. So it sets up the rules for becoming a state. The other thing it does, which is to me the funny part of it, is it is literally a land deal by which the colonies give up their competing claims to the Northwest territories. At that moment in time, Pennsylvania claimed that everything west of Pennsylvania belonged to Pennsylvania. Virginia, because it was Virginia, claimed, well, we own everything west of Pennsylvania too. I mean, you can kind of get it. It's in the general neighborhood. For some reason or another, Connecticut also had a claim to this land, parts of claim to this land, west of Pennsylvania. Well, you can't move forward as the United States of America if we've got multiple states all claiming they own the same thing and blocking new states. And so what the Northwest Ordinance does is resolves those disputes, and it cedes those lands to the United States, right? And it sets up the rules for them to become states. And so this works in direct conjunction with the United States Constitution, which is passed a few months after the Northwest Ordinance. So this is all part of the same package deal. And if you open any copy of the United States Code anywhere in America, the physical copies, it has four foundational documents, the beginning of them. People know three of those documents, right? One is the Declaration of Independence. One is the United States Constitution. The other is the Articles of Confederation, which came what we had before the U.S. Constitution. And the fourth is the Articles of Confederation. So it really is an enormously important document for the foundation of the country, but, you know, not as well taught and understood.
Well, and another complicating factor in the creation of states was slavery, obviously. And we kind of know that story. But the thing that I was struck by was after emancipation, and even during the Civil War, you mentioned how slaves, as soon as they got any aspect of freedom, even if it was just behind the Union Army, immediately started demanding education. And maybe you could, and it seems to me very Jeffersonian, in that, like, I think you know where I'm going with that. So if you could.
Yeah, well, so I'm actually working on a second book that really focuses in squarely on this issue and this issue alone. So I've learned a lot more about it since I wrote Schoolhouse Burning. But I know I'll try not to give away too many spoilers, but sort of just to, and go too long, but just to sort of get to the rub of it. There is a period in which African Americans, including free persons of color and enslaved persons, were reading and writing. So in the late 1700s, early 1800s, it was not completely outlawed. There was a lot of variation. There were some religious groups that thought it was very important to teach slaves to read, that they'd make them better slaves, you know, make them better Christians, et cetera, et cetera. But in the last 30, 40 years leading up to the Civil War, there was a turn, a huge turn, and they saw black literacy as a threat. They saw information itself as a threat, because there were a lot of Northern pamphlets being sent south with anti-slavery rhetoric in them, and so the South really begins. It's sort of the biggest, you know, probably the biggest book banning in America is not, you know, Scope's trial regarding evolution and Cleveland, Tennessee. It is not the current CRT debate. It was the South literally criminalizing the transportation of information into the South that was hostile to slavery. And they even in Charleston, they even broke into the post office and looted the post office because they'd heard that people were sending, you know, these pamphlets via the mail. So it was a very, very heavy regime there. And then criminalizing African-American literacy in addition. So I tell that story because in some ways, education became and learning became the forbidden fruit during that 40-year period. So there was a little bit of freedom to read and write amongst persons of color, and then it becomes the forbidden fruit. And so those African-American families who knew how to read before these laws became so repressive, continued to secretly pass it on to their children. And so there was this sort of underground network of probably, you know, 5% or so, you know, give or take, of African Americans in the South who could read and write. And those were leaders in the community. They had access to information. They knew what was going on in the world. They really had this sort of heightened status. And there was a lot of others who wanted to be part of that community, right? And so they were struggling to they either knew they wanted to read but couldn't do anything about it, or they were secretly, you know, trying to learn to read. And so when the Union comes south and starts to take some areas, then of course physical freedom is the most important thing, but they wanted mental freedom too. So once they got their physical freedom, they quickly start saying, hey, we want to read. And so Northern missionaries are then sent south to these Union controlled areas and start little rudimentary schools. The first one being there in Virginia, down in the Norfolk area, Fort Monroe, which was the very first place and the only place the North held at the beginning of the war. And that movement actually becomes, or is at least a forerunner to Hampton University, which is there in Virginia now. And then here on the wall behind me, at least for those who if you see this online anywhere, or if you have access to the book, there's a picture of the Penn Center here behind me in South Carolina, which was the ultimate Southern experiment. So the North winds the Battle of Port Royal, and the night that they're winning it, the slave owners realize what's happening. They can see the, you know, the fireworks in the sky, basically, and they just desert the South Carolina Sea Islands. And the next morning, when the Union shows up, there are 10,000 formerly enslaved persons there. There's no white folks left. And the Union's kind of like, well, what are we going to do with this, right? You know, we need to keep the economy moving here. We're not in position to run this, though. And so they turn it over into a freedom experiment and allow the freed persons to start to build and run their own societies. And so what's the very first thing they do? They start running schools. And the picture behind me is a picture of what is the very first school ever built exclusively for the instruction of African Americans in the South. And it was built not after the war, but before the war. And so you have this sort of groundswell of people flocking to places to learn and try to learn during the Civil War. And then, you know, I guess we can get to it later if you're interested, but then that then turns into a governmental movement once the war is fully won.
Yeah, and I think that that's one of the things I was struck by in the book is that there's this ebb and flow, I guess, of great educational opportunity for all Americans and especially people of color, and then there's a pushback. Mm-hmm. And that, it seems like there's that's a pattern that happens not only in education but in all civil rights and things. But it's I think maybe if you could speak a little bit about how that happened at the federal level, and then if you want, you can get into the state.
Yeah. So there's two things I'd hope that we could leave readers with or listeners with. And one is that, yes, there has always been this general pushback to civil rights, so that when you have some gains, then there's pushback. And so that's a general principle, and books explore that. Mine is a slice of that. It says, well, can we look at education and freedom as its own thing and extract it from this race question? Not extract it, but sort of integrate it with a larger American narrative. And so the other theme of the book is that every major expansion of access to democracy in America, whether it be expanding, expanding the vote to non-landowners, expanding the vote to women, expanding the vote to African Americans during the Civil War, and then of course that goes away, but then in doing it again sort of later on, that all major expansions of our democracy are coincide with an expansion of public education. And that goes back to everything we just said about Jefferson and Adams earlier. So that if you understand the linkage between democracy and education, those things have to expand together. What we also have, and I don't, you know, whether we call it backlash or something else, but at each moment in time when we have tried to shrink democracy, right, the attempt to shrink it has occurred through the public schools as well, right? That those are a mechanism by which those in power try to reassert and recapture power, is to limit or make unequal the access to public education. So we see that, you know, the Jim Crow era, after Reconstruction, and in Mississippi, you know, the chair of the Constitutional Convention in Mississippi of 1890 shows up and says, you know, we've come here today to do one thing and one thing only, and that is to disenfranchise the Negro. Well, by that, he didn't just mean taking away the vote. You look at that constitutional convention, it took away the vote and it attempted to constrict and take away a lot of education as well, because they understood so long as there is knowledge, there will still potentially be power. So we need to take away the vote and knowledge.
That's interesting. I think to frame it that way, and it also, I think, comes kind of to bring it forward, because I mean the story of Brown and the pushback after Brown versus Board, is kind of well documented, but the kind of bringing it forward, you know, what do you think is happening today with the charters and the vouchers and education policy? I mean, you kind of indict both Obama and Trump in the book, and
not at equivalent levels, though.
Oh, exactly. At equivalent levels, but I think that there are things that both did that were.
Yeah. So, and I try to. I mean, we jokingly use indictment, and I think that's part of the reason why I try to use this historical framework, because, you know, I mean, maybe I would indict, you know, Betsy DeVos, but if we sort of pull, and maybe the Koch brothers, we shouldn't go through my whole indictment list here, but sort of when we pull back, to me, the question isn't like about good guys and bad guys, right? Because I think there are good guys and maybe even bad guys on both sides. There's certainly good guys, I think, on both sides of these debates to some extent, right? There's a lot of families, no doubt, in Ohio, for instance, who've struggled with access to public education, and those families have sought other opportunities. Those aren't bad families. Those are families trying to do right by their children, with those charter schools. And there are people, move outside of Ohio. I don't want to get into Ohio too much, but you know, there's people of faith who've left public schools for reasons of religion. Maybe some of those have for not good reasons, but surely a lot of them are for good reasons. So what the book is saying is, like, let's not get caught up in sort of the good guys, bad guys narrative, but let's ask ourselves, right, that if what is it that our public schools are trying to do for society? What is it they need to do? What place do they hold in society? And then just ask much simpler questions about, well, can charters and vouchers deliver on that, right? Can the level of funding being provided to our schools deliver on that? It's not about, you know, motivations. It's sort of where you fit. And so the answer to that is that, you know, if our charter schools are producing sorting mechanisms, sorting students based upon disability status, based upon ethnicity, based upon race, if they're creating, you know, enclaves in society, and again, you know, we've got problems in our public schools too, but if they're creating enclaves, then that's moving us in the opposite direction of Adams, for instance, right? That's moving us in the opposite direction of all of those state constitutional conventions that were held following the Civil War to try to reframe democracy and rebuild a country. And we could say the same thing about vouchers, right? If what they are doing is separating people, right, and not working towards the common good, then they're not meeting our public education objective. Another thing we can say is that, you know, if our public schools lack the resources, right, or don't have resources that reflect this central role that they play, then that's moving us further away from our goals. And if charters and or vouchers are part of taking those funds away, then they're also moving us further away from our goals. And it doesn't matter what any individual family or person's motive or maker of a charter school. It doesn't matter what their motivations are as a policy matter. It's moving us further away. And so that's how I try to frame it.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important frame to use, because here in Cleveland Heights, in the last, I think, 10 years, the public high school has gone, 98% of the white families have left the high school. So they're still using the K through eight, but since it's the high school, they use the other options. So we're having, at least in Cleveland Heights, and I think you mentioned in the book too, that this kind of creates a resegregation. And that...
Yeah. Well, and I, the other thing, just to add to that, you sort of triggered me, and I think I talk about it in the book as well, is that if our public schools, become the place where poor kids go to school, right? That those are for the poor kids, then the public education project is doomed. So if you're in great local public school A right now, or great suburban, you know, public school A now, and you think, you know, that doesn't really matter for me, that's not my issue. What I'm here to tell you is that we are on a trajectory and a set of ideas that are going to make public school the places that poor kids go to school. And we tried that. That project has been attempted before. It was attempted in Pennsylvania in the 1870s. They said, actually, we're just going to have, you know, we'll let the middle income and higher income, they can figure it out for themselves. And the state's going to be committed to providing public education for poor kids. And what we found was, number one, the poor kids never really got off the ground in a good way. And number two, there was never a commitment by the state to bring quality or even public education at all to many of the, you know, sort of more rural and densely populated places in the state. And so Pennsylvania says, look, we got to do away with this pauper school. We've got to make one big system, and we got to serve everyone in Pennsylvania. And I testified in the school funding litigation this past fall in Pennsylvania about this history. There were some that said, yeah, but these pauper schools, they're special, you know, a lot of charity, we need to keep them. And maybe we need trade schools too, because, you know, these minor, the kids in the mines, like, they need a different education. And the debate said, no, so long as we have different systems of education in our public schools, then we are going to have inferior education. And if we really want to help poor kids, their schools have to be part of everyone else's schools. And I think, you know, that was kind of like forward looking then, like people were like, huh, okay, I guess so, let's try that out. But I think at this point, I think we could hopefully all understand that we need, if you're a public school supporter, that we need a diverse socioeconomic group of people, a diverse racial group of people supporting our public schools. Because if it just becomes only those at the lower ends of the economic scale, it's just going to be a race to the bottom. The state's not going to support that, right? It's going to be a continual struggle. So anyway, long story short, the success of everyone's public school, no matter how wealthy your district is or isn't, or your local district, it depends on the success of all and that common commitment to all. That's what we were committing to in the 1700s, never perfectly achieved it, but we've been trying to get closer and closer across time. And what I see is today is the willingness to take some steps that could set us back decades, if not permanently. It's a turn to failed ideas.
Yeah, and I think we can end on this question. And it's a huge question. We could probably talk about it for hours, but kind of those trends that you were alluding to, like the anti-teacher movement, the anti-union movement, the anti-school funding, to property tax, kind of.
I'm sorry. I mean, you asked me about that a moment ago. I didn't get around. I got off on a long history. So, but you are right. So what I would say is, to bring us to today and the politics of it a bit, is that there is a concerted political movement. We could call it ALEC, the American Legislative Council, the Koch brothers, you know, DeVos Foundation. They've invested a tremendous amount of money in changing education policy. Now, the average citizen might go, why do the Koch brothers care so much about, you know, education policy? Why is ALEC all up in the air about education policy? Why is, you know, I mean, maybe Betsy DeVos, you can kind of get it. But the answer is, they have a fundamental political ideology that is believes in small government and is anti-tax, right? So at the federal level, you kind of get that, right? You can say, oh, that's why they don't like Social Security. That's why they don't like, you know, Medicare, Medicaid. It's like, you know, they want less taxes and smaller government. Well, when you look at state government, you know, public education is by overwhelming margins the thing that state and local government does. It absorbs the lion's share of those funds. So if you want small government, if you want lower taxes at the state level, that means less public education, right? So there is this sort of, you know, libertarian, very sort of, you know, high income crowd that is going after our schools, not because they care about them so much, but they just want smaller government. And so they have tried to undermine or sort of attack some of the political power that supports our public schools. Teacher unions are that, you know. I'm not a public teacher union, you know, defender or critic. There's things they do that, man, I scratch my head and go, that ain't right, you know, as a matter of policy. But I can tell you that they are the most organized and the most important sort of proponent of public education in America. So I think that some of these groups have just vilified and demonized them and created issues that are really just about undermining public education. Right. It's not really about the teacher union. So that's a lot of what's going on there. I also think that the critical race theory debates, for instance, are a combination of factors. And the vaccines too, or the sort of vaccine debate when we were at mask debates, when we were having all that. So I think there, one part of that conversation is just about politicians trying to win elections at the federal level and saying, here we think is a weak spot. There's been a lot of trauma to families and trying to figure out how to make it through the last couple of years. Here's a weak spot. Let's not come up with solutions. Let's just sort of, you know, raise flags and maybe that'll get people stirred up and we'll win votes. So I think that is a lot of what's going on right now in that area. It's just pure old politics, and this just happens to be the issue that works. But if we rewind back to those who are going after public education, I think there's also something distinct going on, which is trying to erode faith in the public education project as a general principle. And how do you erode faith? Well, you don't have to have a proactive policy agenda with good solutions. You just create distrust, chaos, and dissension, right? And so it's just like one thing after another over the last 2 years of just sort of picking at things, making issues, which I believe, at least from that political constituency, is just trying to erode faith in the public education project. And, you know, it has worked to bring down the level of support for public education. Fortunately, 90% of people in America went to public schools. I wouldn't say 90% had a great experience, but a very large chunk have a bit of nostalgia there and look on it favorably. Their kids go there. And so have we lost some public support? Yes, but we still have overwhelming sort of broad level support for our public education, but it's not as organized as these folks who are so in chaos.
Well, thank you for that. And do you have any final suggestions or thoughts on how we should think about this as we move forward in our conversations?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on who the we is. I mean, if we're talking about a we that includes me, you know, I would say that, we've taken a lot for granted for a long time in public education because it is a bipartisan project, and we haven't seen this type of sort of opportunism, at least in my adult lifetime. And we also have, you know, for all the things that people say about unions, I mean, teachers, you know, they're pretty long suffering and quiet. They're not politically active. I mean, maybe, you know, people at the very, very top of the unions at the national levels, right? But the other folks, they're just quiet citizens who, you know, walk their dogs and, you know, stay and teach kids after school and don't talk politics with parents. And parents, regardless of political affiliation, have generally not had to worry about when they cast their ballot for a D or an R, it really having a negative impact on education, because again, it's a bipartisan project, plenty of wonderful leadership out of Republican governors over the years. But we have now entered into a phase in which the idea of public education has become partisan. And so my final word is that for those of us who believe in the public education mission, we cannot sleep on this issue anymore. They have made an issue out of it, and now we have to defend it. And so, yeah, if you're out there, you're listening, you care about your public schools, we can't sit on the sidelines anymore. This is a top level issue that has to be voted on. And you have to look at your candidates, and you can't assume anything about them.
Thanks for listening to Unpacking 1619. For more information on Heights Library 1619 Project Discussion Group, or to check out more interviews with scholars, please visit heightslibrary.org. See you next episode, wherever you listen to podcasts.